Morning.
Morning, Your Honor. My name is Brian Isaacson. May it please the Court, I'd like to schedule 8 minutes for the opening, 7 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well. Keep track of your time. I'll try to help you.
Okay. Thank you. The reason that we're here is, number one, is to ask the Court to review, to make the determination de novo that our client, Kurt Sulberger, is entitled to the safe harbor under Section 1058 of the Internal Revenue Code. In this case, we have a transaction that was a deposit into an account.
Before you get there, if I may, Mr. Isaacson, as you know, the tax court relied on Grote and McKay Realty, Inc. as the 8 criteria, if you will, for its determination that a sale had occurred here. Do you believe that that is, in fact, the controlling law, if you will, since we don't have a specific case that says so in the Ninth Circuit as to whether a sale occurred?
Well, we believe that Section 1058, the safe harbor, is the controlling law here. The second thing that I was going to ask the Court to do is to reverse the motion for summary judgment and then allow evidentiary hearing on the Grote versus McKay factors. Let me talk about the Grote versus McKay factors. Is that under Grote versus McKay?
I think we have a Ninth Circuit decision that doesn't use the 8-factor test.
Well, what we're saying is that one of the factors in the test needs to be whether or not the property was obtained by deception, whether or not there was a theft, transfer was induced by fraud, which is what we really have here. And that is not part of the Grote versus McKay factors, although it can be part of the 8-factor test in terms of the way that the test should be analyzed.
I think what we do in the Ninth Circuit is we just determine the point at which the benefits and burdens of ownership were transferred.
Well, that's
under Gray, and it looks to me like here they were transferred when he purportedly pledged the stock because he didn't have any right to get it back for 7 years, and he didn't try to get it back during the moments or days between the time he supposedly pledged it and it was sold.
Well, a pledge requires a loan. Am I correct?
Well, what you look at in tax law is economic substance. The paperwork can't turn a sale into something else if it does not represent the economic substance. And what we have held, in accord with what the Supreme Court has held, is that the bright and shining light is a non-recourse loan, which is what you have here.
Well, what we're saying is that we don't even have a loan here. In fact, there have been several.
I thought you had a loan agreement, but it's non-recourse.
We have a loan agreement that contains two parts. One are the pre-loan covenants. The other are the post-loan covenants. And there have been several courts, including Callaway, that have determined that there was no loan in this transaction. That there was just simply a deposit.
It's a sale.
Well, it's a deposit into an account, and the reason that it's not
it's a sale.
Sale is under the pre-loan covenants.
I thought either it's a loan or it's a sale. After all, he transfers stock, and they transfer money to him.
Well, it's a deposit in this case. There are three steps to the transaction. The first is the deposit into the account. If there were a legitimate lender, then there would be a pledge, which case there would be a sale. But under the pre-loan covenants, there's only a deposit here because the courts determined that there was no loan.
At what point did Mr. Sulberger conclude that this was a fraud?
Well, it wasn't actually until after the IRS had audited the transaction.
Let me think. He made 3 loan payments, and I use that term based on what the document said. He did not know at that point that there was a problem?
He didn't know that there was a problem until Derivium filed bankruptcy, and then the IRS later audited him.
Okay, he made the loan payments until the filing of the bankruptcy?
Until the filing of the bankruptcy, and then what happened was the IRS audited him, he didn't even learn that there was a sale until after the IRS informed him of the fact.
Loan payments. Did he make regular payments?
He made regular payments. He truly believed that there was a loan, and that was what he had contracted for. In fact, he didn't learn that there was a sale until almost 5 years after, when the IRS audited him. And
how much did he pay total compared to the 90% price that he got?
As far as the interest payments?
How much did they give him, and how much did he give them?
He got 90%. The pledge was for $1 million. He got $900,000.
And how much did he pay them?
He paid them $100, but he's filed a lawsuit now to recover the $100 and also recover the collateral, and that lawsuit is still pending.
The collateral was sold almost immediately, wasn't it?
Which he didn't know at the time. He didn't
learn. How can he recover that if it's already been sold? Why don't you have a sale for value to somebody, or was it a co-conspirator somewhere?
Yeah, there's a co-conspirator with Wachovia Bank and Morgan Keegan, and the sale took place between the conspiracy was between some brokers on the inside of Morgan Keegan and inside of Wachovia, who were working in conjunction with Derivium. And what we've argued is that rescission is a remedy where there's fraud involved, and there was clearly fraud involved here.
I don't get how you get it back. It's kind of like if you pledge a guitar to a pawnbroker and he sells it before your redemption time is up.
Well, that is an analogy, but I guess the question.
So why isn't it a precise analogy?
Well, it's not a precise analogy, because with a pawnbroker, the pawnbroker has the right to sell the shares once they're pledged.
Not until the redemption time is expired. He can't sell the guitar until the time for the pledgor to redeem it has ended.
Well, the contract doesn't allow anybody to sell their shares until such time as there's a legitimate loan in play. And I think the difference is I think the pawnbroker analogy, everybody knows what the rules of the game are. Here
they were free to sell the stock as soon as couple of days had passed. And during those couple of days, I think it was days, might have been longer, there was no attempt made to redeem it.
Well, the agreement.
So it looks
actually,
like when they sold the stock, they had a right to under the agreement.
No, under the agreement, it says that only a lender can sell the shares, and the reason for the agreement is to preclude the sale to fund the loans. And here you had a misrepresentation: one, that there was a lender; two, that there was a legitimate loan. And then not only that, the tax court in Judge Holmes' minority opinion ruled that what we really have here is a sale of his stock deposited with a theft of 10%.
Mr. Isaacson, I don't know if you wanted to stay with this, but you're under your 7 minutes. If you wish, you save that for rebuttal, but it's up to you.
Yeah, I'd like to go a little bit further, because respondent has put in the Anschultz case, and respondent has specified four factors that I know that the panel is considering. The first is whether or not the purchaser bears the risk of loss and opportunity for gain. Well, what you have is a transfer to a thief and a theft of the collateral, and you don't have, and then you have the thief selling the shares. So you don't have, under the contract, a transfer of the risk of loss, because under the pre-loan covenants in the contract, there's the right to the immediate return of the shares if all the conditions aren't fulfilled.
He didn't exercise that.
Well,
Didn't try to.
He didn't. Are you saying he didn't exercise the immediate right to the return, or
the agreement says either party can terminate the agreement prior to the lender receiving the notes or entering into what they called hedging transactions. So that's phony. They're not hedging transactions.
They're not hedging.
But here, the lender did receive the notes, and although the lender had not entered into the so-called hedging transactions, Solberger did not exercise his right to terminate at that point.
But there was no lender, and that's where the disparity is the tax court in their decision that they held there was no loan.
I guess that's a part of your argument I don't understand. There's got to be either a lender or a buyer, because they get notes and they pay money. If you say there's no lender, it seems like, well, that's what the IRS is saying.
Right. We all agree that there was no lender, but what we're saying is that there's a deposit and a theft. What the IRS is saying is that there was no lender, but yet we can apply the post-loan covenants to determine whether the safe harbor under 1058 is effective. And we're saying you can't have it both ways. If there's no lender, you can't analyze the safe harbor under 1058 as though there has been a loan. You have to treat the transaction as just simply a deposit where he has the right to the immediate return, and he's exercised that right, and he's filed a lawsuit to rescind the contract to obtain the return of his
I don't understand. Why would he deposit the stock?
There are two steps. It's common in brokerage accounts where you can deposit stocks in a brokerage account.
Sure.
You can
put them in later, street name.
Right, you put them in street name, and then you later take a loan out under Reg T. And not only that, but also the Reg T requirements. In every single brokerage contract, it allows the brokerage house to sell the shares, to sell, hypothecate, transfer the shares, because they go into street name at
so
that
you're saying
point.
This is like putting them in street name and borrowing against that collateral.
Yeah, that was the intention of the transaction. Only unlike a broker loan, Derivium misrepresents the transaction. And
well, the thing that would seem to be unlike the standard brokerage loan is it's non-recourse.
Well, that's a good point.
What's the response to it?
Well,
I mean, as I recall, the difference between Frank Lyon and I can't remember the other Supreme Court case, the bookend, and in our case in Sachs, non-recourse is the first thing you look for.
Well, I think non-recourse is a factor, but I think before you can go to recourse versus non-recourse, you have to ask the question of whether there's a loan.
Is there anything on the record to indicate that your client had other colleagues or friends who had done similar transactions with this entity?
Well, the tax court opinion indicates that there were over 1,400 transactions. There's another case on appeal, Callaway case is on appeal in the 11th Circuit, which we had argued in January.
But my specific question though was whether your client was aware, do you have friends or others, does the record say your friend, he had friends or others that he knew that had participated in this program?
No, our client did not.
Okay.
Okay.
You want to save any of your time?
Sure. What I'd like to do is just take a minute and talk about the pre-loan versus the post-loan covenants on the safe harbor.
It's up to you.
Under Section 1058. Under that provision, if you look at the post-loan covenants, our client has the right to the immediate return of the collateral, and thus he does follow in the provisions under Samueli, which we quote on page 14 of our brief. So he's able to terminate the loan, the contract, upon demand before there's a legitimate loan here. And what we're saying is that actually if you look at the substance over form of the transaction, what you have is a deposit and a theft. You don't have a pledge and a loan.
Okay.
You got 35 seconds, but okay.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Andy Weiner for the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. The benefits and burdens test to determine whether there's been a sale for tax purposes follows from the venerable doctrine of tax law that you follow substance over form. That test applies to this case to determine whether taxpayer has income from the sale of the FRNs, the floating rate notes, to Optech. And as the tax court found, the undisputed evidence in this case supports that there was a sale at every relevant factor that you look to.
Now, give the reasons why you think that despite Optech selling the stock before they had a right to sell the stock, it should not be treated as akin to a deposit of stock with a stockbroker and street name and then misconduct by the stockbroker.
I think what you look to, Your Honor, is you look to the agreement, and I don't think there's any...
I'm looking at it. Show me where.
I do not think that there's any suggestion in the agreement that that the fact that the loan was funded from independent sources other than the FRNs, other than the notes, is a condition precedent. And so, therefore, what you have is, by the terms of the agreement itself, the loan closes upon the surrender of the notes and the funding of the loan. And at that point, taxpayer may have an argument that Optech breached the loan, breached the term of the loan. And it appears that they are seeking a remedy by suing Optech for damages under that breach. However, that does not mean that they had intended to enter into this transaction and that the transaction actually went through that. You know, governed by the master agreement.
The one thing that kind of raised a question in my mind, once I saw non-recourse, I assumed that, well, he gets 90 cents on the dollar for his stock, and in exchange he gets a package of tax benefits worth considerably more than the dime. Seemed kind of straightforward. But since it is non-recourse, I can't figure out why he's paying them back.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think the loan is really designed to be paid back, which is why it's not a loan and it's a sale.
But he says he was making payments on it.
He did make three payments. So he payments,
he made $100,000 in
payments? No. I believe that Taxpayers Council misspoke. He received $900,000 to close the transaction, and then as provided under the master agreement, Optech determined how much interest came in on the note, the accrued interest on the note, and then calculated the amount of interest that was owed under the master agreement, the purported loan that was entered into between the parties, and billed taxpayer for the difference.
And what did he get billed for?
He got billed for about $1,000 in one quarter, about $1,300 in another quarter. And I don't believe that there's a check in the record to determine how much he paid for the third quarter.
Oh, the payments
but let's
were
say it was between $1,000 and
payments were de minimis then.
They were relatively
compared
de
to the
compared to the yeah the $900,000 that he received. Yes, and so what you have is you have Your Honor.
Where do we look in the agreement to find out what the deal is on these billings?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last.
Where do we look in the agreement to find out what the deal is on those billings?
Oh, the agreement provides that that there is a term in the agreement that talks about that they will be billed on a quarterly basis. I believe it is in Schedule A. If you look at interest payments, so it would be paragraph 4 describes the interest rate on the notes that were surrendered, and paragraph 5 discusses the interest payments on the collateral.
Now, what's the SCR number?
It would be 35, Your Honor.
Thanks.
And it talks about quarterly net interest payments that are due. And you also have another factor of that, which would be paragraph 6, which would be a late payment penalty.
It looked to me like the way it's structured, being non-recourse and the like, that at the end of the 7-year term, that in effect the taxpayer had the right to either try to get it back by paying the amount that was owed or just letting it go. Is that the correct analysis of what the agreement provided?
Yeah, they effectively had sold the notes for 90 cents on the dollar
right.
with a right to redeem in 7 years.
So they basically had a call option, in effect.
They had a call option, which is completely consistent with, there's a case that we cite, a somewhat old case in the tax court, in which they say that's completely explicable by the fact that when you take a mild haircut on the purchase price, with a call option, that is something that is a little bit a variant from a sale, but a sale nonetheless. Mm-hmm. And that is effectively what you have here. The taxpayer in this case completely surrendered the benefits and burdens of ownership in the notes for the duration of the 7 years, and then at the 7 years got to walk away and keep the entire amount of the proceeds that they received, all $900,000. And that, Your Honors, we submit is a sale under the tax law, regardless of whether taxpayer believed it or not.
Let's see, I guess at the end of the 7 years, unlike the guitar, he doesn't get his original guitar back. If it were an honest outfit, he just gets an equivalent number of shares of the same company.
Yeah, and there I think, Your Honor, is perhaps a little bit of a wrinkle, because we're dealing with fungible property.
And that's what I'm asking.
You consistently see case law struggle or reconcile. I would say
if it was a guitar and he had a right to get his guitar back in 7 years, that'd be a lot more like a loan rather than just a call option.
Paragraph 8 makes clear that Elvis has left the building, right?
Paragraph 8 is
that's the return of the collateral, where it says they can fungible, basically.
Yeah, but the thing is that the Supreme Court has said that, you know, the Supreme Court in Richardson, the first of the two, you know, major Supreme Court cases at issue here, the Supreme Court says that, listen, it's not important that you get the exact same stock back when you deposit it in a safekeeping account, or you deposit in a subordination loan context where, you know, it was a margin account. So that alone is not dispositive of a sale, and that's not what the government is arguing in this case. What we're saying is that you look to the benefits and the burdens of ownership, which includes the fact that Optek was able to put the collateral in its name, that Optek had the ability to sell it without notice to taxpayer, that Optek had the use of enjoyment of the notes,
so whether
Optek's. They sold it or not. Yeah, for the entire duration of the 7 years. And if at the end of the 7 years he says he wants it back, then Optek has to go out into the market and get it. If Optek doesn't do it, then you have a contract claim against Optek. But what you do have, from the taxpayer standpoint, is you have a sale.
That's
our position. And you're sticking with it. I think so, right?
Unless there are any other questions, I think we'll
rest. I don't think so. I believe you've got like 30 seconds left, counsel. We'll let you have that if you'd like.
Well, we disagree with everything that he's saying, and we would like a case remanded to the tax court for at least an evidentiary hearing on the intention of the parties in light of the pre-loan covenants and the post-loan covenants. If you take a look at Section 5 of the Master Loan and Financing Agreement, that ability to sell is only during the loan term, and the evidence is that the sale took place before the loan term as defined on Schedule A. In this case, there was a deposit and a theft.
Wasn't a loan. I think we got your point.
Okay,
thank you very much. The case just argued is submitted. And the court stands adjourned for the week.
Thank you.